is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Subcommittee on Public Safety. Today is March 15th, 2017. I am opening up. We're going to start the work session. Work session with the Judicial Department for a federal grant application. Mr. Bender, would you walk us through it first? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and Subcommittee members. The Judicial Department applied for a grant at a time when the legislature was not meeting and able to provide authorization for that application as was required by law. Under the our processes, Ways and Means processes, they notified the legislative leadership that this grant award was due before they were able to obtain legislative approval. They went ahead and applied, and now they're asking for you to approve that application retroactively. If Ways and Means does not do so, the agency will withdraw its grant application. What the Judicial Department has applied for is a grant from the Justice for Families program, which is administered by the Office of Violence Against Women in the U.S. Department of Justice. They've applied for $550,000 for continued support of the Family Court Enhancement Project in the Multnomah County Circuit Court. There are materials in OLIS posted. There's the agency request letter and the LFO analysis posted for today's subcommittee meeting in OLIS. Please let me know if you have any questions locating that. Before we begin, I would just like to point out that after this, when you go back to the agency's budget presentation, that document is still posted on Monday's committee meeting in OLIS, the 13th. So they're in two separate places.
Okay. All right, you're on.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, my name is David Moon. I'm the Director of the Business and Fiscal Services at the Oregon Judicial Department. Today we're here to request retroactive approval to apply for a federal grant. As Mr. Bender mentioned, this is in the Office of Violence Against Women in the U.S. Department of Justice for Families Program Grant. It's up to $550,000 for the Multnomah County Circuit Court's Family Court Enhancement Project. We have been successful in applying for grants in the past, and we have Mr. Neil Jabbour here with us this morning who will describe some of the program. Briefly, I'll just mention this is to assist pro se litigants who are involved in domestic cases with domestic violence involved. This is for two staff positions for up to 3 years, and there are no grant matching requirements. With that, I'll let Mr. Jabbour introduce himself.
So I'm Neil Jabbour. I'm the Deputy Trial Court Administrator for Multnomah County. Nice to meet you, everyone. And I know that there were some questions about some of our achievements of what we've done in the last few years. And I have a short list, and I look back now and think these are all wonderful achievements that we've made throughout the year. So. Our first step when we received the initial grant was to conduct focus groups with DV survivors, attorneys, and child custody evaluators. And we were evaluating what their experiences were with the family court. And out of that, we came up with a number of areas that we wanted to focus on. And part of it, one of them was us that we realized self-represented, we've sort of known this, self-represented litigants needed more support and information during their process working in family court, going through the family court process. The second area that we were focusing on were family law professionals, lawyers, custody evaluators, mediators, and advocates needed better information relating to identifying domestic violence and its impact on families. And the third area that was there was a perception of our focus groups, of the people involved in our focus groups, that the court was not always procedurally fair to litigants. So those were our three areas of focus. Some of the achievements that we've gotten completed are we've conducted training on trauma-informed practices and procedural fairness for judges, staff, domestic violence advocates, and child custody attorneys. We implemented a family court navigator position as one of our positions who provides individual support to families who have custody and parenting time issue or cases going through the system, and they're providing us individual support for them, which we realized that was needed. We developed a training tool for families, for family law attorneys, to screen and to prepare for cases involving that have domestic violence involved parents. And we conducted a court-wide survey on procedural fairness to determine sort of a baseline of where we were and what the work that we've been doing over the last couple of years. If we could track that, and then we're going to be doing another survey in the next year to evaluate what outcomes we've improved. So, and one of the last things was we simplified a number of our court forms to our court forms are very complicated, and we've focused on simplifying them so they're more of at an eighth grade reading level for people that are coming to the court. They're very complicated. They're very complex. So, and the last issue, process that we're working on, we're developing four videos for use in the court in Multnomah County. We believe those will probably be available to other courts if appropriate. So,
questions?
Any questions?
What indication do you have that you're going to receive this grant?
Well, we've applied for the grant, so I hope that we're going to have an opportunity. We had, I think we had very good success with the last grant. We have a relationship with all of the with VAWA, so we're hoping that we will get it approved.
Mr. Bender, your recommendation?
Yes, the Legislative Fiscal Office does recommend that you approve the submission of the federal grant application retroactively. If the application is successful, OJD will come back in the 2018 session to request a federal funds expenditure limitation increase to allow the funds to be spent.
Can I have a motion?
Sure. Co-Chair Winters, I move that we approve the OJD federal grant application and that it be retroactive. Do I need to say anything else?
No.
All right.
Co-Chair Stark recommends that we approve the federal grant application and that you can proceed to submit it to the federal government. I do think we don't have to take it to full.
You will be taking
this
to full.
Taken to full.
So we'll ask you to designate a carrier to.
I'll take it. So with that, any objection? Hearing none.
Thank you.
Opening the public hearing on House Bill 5013, Judicial Department. Chief going to be here? Is he going to sit in with? Are you going to bring the other Judge Waller up with you as well, or is she just going to?
I'm observing. I'll be back tomorrow.
Okay.
Hello, Judge Waller. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Mr. Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, members, I'm Phil Lemon from the State Court Administrator's Office. I would like to walk today with you through our policy option packages and explain what those are about and why they're important to the Judicial Department. So on this slide, you are seeing again the major elements of the Chief Justice recommended budget. These are the priorities the Chief Justice discussed with you briefly on Monday. It's keeping courts open and making sure that they can process cases in a timely manner and that we have the central supports to help them work toward best practices and work at their efficient best. To continue the benefits from eCourt, we successfully completed implementation throughout the state last year, and now we are working to refine and make sure we can get the best data, the best business processes, again, to help our stakeholders work on a consistent basis with the courts so there are not so many individual processes that they have to follow in each court. These are developing I-forms for self-represented litigants. We'll talk about those some more. And also the training, maintenance, and all the business process, the kind of behind-the-curtain things that are needed to maintain this system. The Odyssey system is now a case management system that the courts use on a daily basis, but it's also a system that allows us to produce the reports for our management to give you data on how the courts are doing and to make sure that our internal and external users have the services that they need. Judicial compensation is a continuing priority for the Chief Justice. We're not sure what it is about the judicial branch, but you'll hear from the Office of Public Defense Services as well as the Judicial Department that salaries in our branch lag behind the executive branch. And that makes it more difficult for us to recruit and retain and make sure we have the quality lawyers that we need to move our processes forward. The legislature has generously agreed to provide state support to replace unsafe county courthouses. We are in the approaching the home stretch in Multnomah County, our state's largest court. That will be our biggest request. We were looking for continued support for the Lane County Courthouse Project, which was approved in 2016. And we have two new counties who would like to begin the process of receiving that state bond assistance to replace unsafe courthouses in their counties. We have some specific requests, as the chief mentioned, for targeted additions for judicial resources. We have not received a new judge in 10 years or more, and this is another pressing need that we have not been able to work with the legislature to meet, but we want to continue to bring that to your attention. And then we have other POPs for that are the Chief Justice priorities for adequate staffing in specialty courts and assisting self-represented litigants.
Mr. Lemon, is there any specific area in specialty courts that you're actually thinking about?
Madam Co-Chair, the POP that we have is basically expenditure limitation for grant-funded courts. We have come in the past and asked you to provide permanent funding for those drug court treatment coordinators. We chose not to do that this time because of the financial circumstances and not knowing what is going to happen with the CJC budget. But many of those, and I'll get into this a little more detail later, but many of those positions were lost in the reductions in the recession in 2009. And those went from being permanent staff positions in OJD to relying on biennial grant funding from the CJC and also some that are from federal and other sources. But we're going to hold tight on that one and kind of keep do with what we've got for now. Did that answer your question, Senator?
Yes. Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Phil, is there something on OLIS that shows the breakdown if we can fund the additional 10 positions where they would be distributed throughout the state? The reason I ask selfishly is, you know, Deschutes County has long urged additional judicial slots for Central Oregon, and so I'm just kind of curious if there's a document that shows where the placement would be.
Madam Chair, Rep. Huffman, yes, those are listed on a later slide. I don't believe the 7th Judicial District has any of the positions. Again, the Chief Justice, we did a workload study with the judicial officers that showed the need for 30 new judges. That was narrowed down. Yes, thank you. That was narrowed down to 9, but there are none in the 7th Judicial District that would be covered in this round. But again, this is a longstanding need, basically statewide.
Thank you.
But there'll be a slide that shows which counties we're focusing in on this. So this lists all the POPs in numerical order. The ones that relate to the Chief Justice priorities that I just reviewed are shaded. And so I will be walking through those in priority order. If we can go to the next slide, please. The last two policy option packages, 420 and 421, are a vehicle to get the Law Commission additional budget requests to this body so you can consider those. And Mr. Shetterly will be here at the end of the day to discuss those with you. But I won't be covering those. So the first priority POP is for the State Technology Fund, State Court Technology Fund, number 404. This is the fund that was created by the legislature in 2013 to pay for support and maintenance for our technology support systems and services. And so this is both the what you would think of as IT technology staff. It has staff in our other divisions to make the system work better and, again, do some of that support maintenance. Anytime there's a patch or a fix that comes through, our office tests that before it's released to make sure it does what we want it to do and we can make it work with what we have. So this is kind of the centralized funding source for all those systems and services. When the legislature approved this fund in 2013, we were looking for a funding method to fund our e-filing service. So with eCourt, all attorneys can electronically file from a remote location 24/7. So instead of having to have that document at the courthouse by 4/59/59, they can basically email it through our e-filing service 24/7. And so that gives them extra time. It helps the court because we don't have to handle so much paper.
Madam Chair,
Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Phil, is this inclusive of, or is there going to be a different item for the e-court? The chief was talking the other day about ongoing expenses of maintaining e-court upgrades, et cetera, and so on. Is that different, or is that included in this package?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Huffman, this is it.
Okay.
This is the one. This is primarily funded now through a portion of the 5% increase in statutory filing fees on civil and family law cases, as well as the user fees that we charge for access to some of these services. When we did that in 2013 and 2014, we informed the legislature and worked with stakeholders to know that this was a limited duration fix, and that as more e-filings came into online, that we would need additional funding, and as these additional services came online, that we'd be looking for funding support for those. So this has been something that I hope comes as no surprise to anybody. We've been giving interim reports to emergency boards and Ways and Means Committee and working with stakeholders. So this is just the time where we need to focus in on some of that and make some decisions.
Phil, do we have the maintenance contractors, that's still the same individual, and what's the life of that contract?
Madam Co-Chair, it is the same contract. I am not looking for a lifeline for that, but I can get you the answer. The contract that we signed had a maintenance built in during the implementation period, and so now that we're in operations mode, we have a new contractual maintenance fee that applies, and so that's part of what we're looking to fund in this.
So when you return package. And we start doing the dive in, and you know, with the specifics, would you actually bring in those figures of what the new contracts look like and what the percentage of the commission is? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Phil, back to during the early days of implementation, we had a conversation about setting up portals, secure portals for outside vendors. Under the old system, they had access to certain amounts of court information. And early on, you were having to be very careful in setting up portals in the new e-court system. Did those end up getting worked out over the last two or three years to allow vendors? Because I know you mentioned the revenue from outside vendors accessing information, so I was wondering if that got worked out so we are getting some of that revenue.
Madam Co-Chair, Rep. Huffman, there are two sources of user fee revenue. One is private businesses with business uses for court information can subscribe to OJSON, is what we call it, the Oregon Judicial Case Information Network. And that gives them not only the calendar data that you can, is similar to what you see on OLIS for the measure history, it also gives them what you have, the analogous piece is the meeting materials. And so they have direct access to most court case documents. Some things like juvenile we restrict access to, adoption, some of those things are, we just don't let anybody look at, and some we let look at if they have a legit business need to do so. The other piece is what we call bulk data, and that is a much more comprehensive set of data where you don't have to go case by case by case. It's a prepared set of specific fields, so we'll have name, address, there may be dates of birth in there, partial dates of birth, and that is sent to basically people who are data resellers or legal research companies.
I think that was the category.
Yes, and so that is an ongoing system that we support. It is part of this package, and it will be part of the fee structure.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I never had circled back around to see if that had ever been built into the new system.
Yeah, there's kind of a wholesale and a retail approach, if you will. One is just a data set that we provide on a regular basis and update, and the other is, again, being able to go in on a case-by-case basis, whether you're an attorney or you want to see if a person has been convicted, you can search by name, you can search by party defendant, all kinds of things.
Okay, thank you.
So the outcomes of funding this package would be, first of all, to fund the software and licensing system maintenance costs, and that's just the basic costs of doing business. We have that new contractual maintenance fee. The second is to ensure the viability and response times in the new system. And this is, again, kind of the basic technical and structural supports that we need to make this system work both for the internal users and for our external customers. We have increased use of the e-filing system. Anytime somebody e-files into a court that where a filing fee applies, the vendor charges OJD $5 per envelope. And so we can put multiple documents in an envelope. We cannot file multiple cases in a single envelope. So if you have a motion and an affidavit relating to the same case, those go in the same envelope and goes in, but you can't file 16 small claim cases or landlord-tenant eviction cases in one envelope. So we've gone statewide with that since about September of last year. It is mandatory for use by all members of the Oregon State Bar. And because of that increased usage, we have increased user charges. And so per the stakeholder agreement and the legislative approval in 2014, we use a statutory filing fee revenue to come into the tech fund and support that those payments. The other thing involves, again, some of the behind-the-curtain things, but also the things that are important for OJD as an institution, and I think for the legislature as it fulfills its oversight roles. Again, we want a system that is secure and has room for improvements and to fix problems. That's what the implementation of the patches and upgrades do. The prompt user support training and communication, again, that is, we have about 10,000 internal and external users, and so that these monies help fund the help desk functions, the trainings. We do personal trainings. We do webinars. We do computer-based trainings. So there's a wide variety of training resources. We look at where we can use consistency statewide to make our processes, the court processes, more efficient and also make them more user-friendly to the bar members and litigants. When we were first starting this process and beginning with eCourt, we would hear from some attorneys saying, well, when I file this case in County A, they want the documents in order of A, B, C, D. And when I file in County B, they want A, C, B, D. Why is that? So that's an example of where a statewide business process with consistent practices helps both the courts and the external bar. Just, we learned a lot about how many lawyers practice in multiple counties throughout the state and use our e-filing system. Another efficiency, the Chief Justice talked about iForms, and these are, for those of you who are already getting ready to prepare your taxes and use software, this is kind of the, sorry, did I hit a tender spot when I was in the start?
No, I've been done with mine for a month.
Oh, well,
sorry.
You're
show
way ahead
off.
Of me.
Show off.
Okay, I shouldn't have brought that up.
No, you shouldn't have.
But those are what is generically called interview-based forms, and it takes your information and fills out the appropriate forms and prepares them for you to approve and file. This is the judicial equivalent. If you have a small claims case, a landlord-tenant, a family law case, the chief talked about how this helps people access the courts. These forms are written to the eighth grade level, so they're very understandable, they're easy to use, they can be electronically filed, and as importantly to us, it makes sure that these people submit all the information that is statutorily required so we can adjudicate their cases and we don't have this constant back and forth, well, you didn't provide this, well, you didn't provide that. That doesn't help anybody's mood or moving that case along and getting it handled. The other thing that's important for us is being able to respond to law changes. And this is a biannual situation now where if you change law, we have coding that we need to do. We need to change our form, so we're now meeting the new statutory requirements, and that is just an ongoing process for us, again, and the staff that do that, the analysis and the development are funded through the tech fund. So I've talked a little bit about the transaction fees for e-filing. We provide free access to the public to court calendars, and that means that anybody can log in. They can search what's going on in Multnomah County on this day. What is going on with this defendant? What is going on? Well, how many cases does this judge have on the docket today? And those are all available free of charge to the public. I talked about OJSON and the access to the court case documents. We have a large number of government users that we provide this service to free of charge. That doesn't mean it doesn't cost us anything to open the account, to set up the account, to figure out what rights and responsibilities and access privileges they should have and to maintain that. It just means that we don't charge them. Our philosophy here is following with legislative approaches in the past. If they don't pay a filing fee for that case type, then we don't charge them a user fee. The interview-based forums, again, we've talked about. Another outcome is the business process and training functions. We've talked about the consistency. The reporting is something I think is near and dear to all of us. We've talked about some of the changes in case filings and how we're still trying to sort through some of those things and analyze that a little more finely and make sure that we can report to you with a higher degree of confidence what is going on with the courts, where the problem areas are. And so we have a full-time data analyst who is running these reports, developing these reports, and just figuring out what the ins and outs of this new system are so we know what we can and cannot say with accuracy and bring you information that we and you need to manage and oversee the system. And then, again, the training and peer networking. We bring staff in for group trainings, whether they are small, they handle small claims cases or new clerks or supervisors, and make sure that they understand what the law changes are and how our business process has been fashioned to adapt to those, and making sure that we are acting more and more like a unified state system instead of, as the chief talked about, this kind of conglomeration with a lot of decentralization and local control. Technical services, again, help desk for internal and external users. We have the patches and annual updates and the law changes. And we also are able to centralize some accounting services in Salem so courts don't have to dedicate staff, whole or portions of staff, to do that task. They can assign that to our central office, and that gets done on their behalf. So this gives you a little idea of who some of our external users are. We have about 1,700 users in OJD, and about five times that many outside of the department. So these are the subscribers to OJSON, our court information system. I want to make sure that you understand that we do offer the public access to this information, but only at the courthouse kiosks. So if they have a question or want to see documents in a particular case, they can identify that through the calendar process and the search process that's free to the public. They can go to the courthouse, and there's a public kiosk there where they can access this. We're not at the stage where we can adequately secure the private and confidential information to open that up on a broader basis, but that is available at the courthouse, just as if you were interested, you could go to the courthouse and ask to see this case file. So these folks are non-paying public subscribers. There's about 5,000 and about 60% of our total. The state agency users, these include attorneys who contract with the Office of Public Defense Services to provide indigent defense. And again, if their practice is half-time or more indigent defense, then we provide them free access to OJSON. If it's less than that, they are treated like the private bar and have a paid subscription. Department of Justice is another significant user on the state side, and Department of Human Services and CASAs also have access to this. On the local government side, it's about 40% of these non-paying public users. And if you want to slice and dice between civil and criminal, about half are public safety, either, again, those indigent defense providers or law enforcement entities. So that just gives you an idea of who our public entity customers are. On the flip side, in the private sector, we have about 3,500 paying subscribers. About not quite two-thirds of those are private attorneys and law firms. Another about approximately 20% are the data brokers, and these are the bulk data customers. There's only about a dozen of those. But people who do background investigations, whether those are landlords, private investigators, financial institutions doing credit checks, we have some news media customers, we have title companies. All these people have a business use for that court information, and so once they meet that threshold, they can subscribe and get that information. I would also just, as we get into this, who's paying for what and why is it important and how much should we charge them? When the Oregon State Bar, through our quality assurance provider, when we were in the implementation stage, he worked with the Oregon State Bar to do a survey, kind of a customer satisfaction, how's it going as we close out this process. That was in May of 2016. People who responded to that, and it was not a majority of the bar, just to be clear, but 80% had used the system, two-thirds said that it expanded access to the court. About 60% said it increased their productivity, and not quite half said it reduced their cost. So We think that there are really significant and substantial benefits to the private bar, and so we can't quantify and say, well, we saved you this much in filing and service costs, and therefore you should pay this much for access. But we do think that there are really significant financial benefits to the bar, and it makes their practice more efficient and effective, as well as the court processes. On the specific components of this package, the file and serve increase is about $2.2 million. Again, this is the mandatory and statewide e-filing that we're now getting into, as well as the I-forms that can be e-filed. The staff, this is, again, the technical support, the testing, the reporting, the training, the I-form development, the business process review, that's about $3.3 million. The software license and maintenance, some of these are ongoing things like server replacement, network costs, as well as the new contractual maintenance fee, which is about $2.3 million. We do have not quite $900,000 in a cash reserve, so our need in 17-19 to keep our services at their current level is about $8 million. So what are we going to do about that? We have outlined the potential structure for a revenue proposal and want to kind of see what your response is to that, how we can work with you to resolve that, and also work for the stakeholders so they understand what the need is and what their reaction would be. We would propose a 5% increase in all the statutory filing fees. And again, the agreement with the stakeholders and the legislature in 2014 was we would use filing fees to pay for those e-filing transaction costs. And since those are going up, we're asking for that increase in filing fees.
You said all the stakeholders. Are all the stakeholders in agreement?
We have not reviewed this in detail with them yet, Senator, so I can't say that.
But you do plan to, because I'm particularly, yes, on the civil filings?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Steiner.
As you go through these, Mr. Lemon, can you please just let us know when the last time was you increased them?
When we started.
We started, but nope, not all.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, yes.
Thank you. Well, remember, I'm
The civil filing fees were last increased in 2014, and just to be clear, these are statutory filing fee increases.
Right.
So we don't do that. We ask you to do that.
More accurately, when did you last ask the legislature to,
yes,
do that? 14. When did the legislature last agree to you?
2014, there was a 5% increase in these filing fees, and 4.75% of that 5% goes into the tech fund. The general fund gets the other magnificent 0.25%.
Fabuloso. Thank you.
So we are also asking that the civil filing fees pay a proportionate share of the software licensing supplies and the staffing costs that we've talked about. To help address the non-paying customers, which are mostly public safety and state agencies, we're proposing a $5 increase in criminal fines. Now, to answer Senator Steiner Hayward's question, fines were generally reduced in 2011, and Representative Barker can, yep, tell all kinds of stories about that process. But what basically happened on both the civil side and the offense side in 2011 is the legislature looked at the entire system on civil fees and offense fines. And as you can imagine, over time, we added kind of this and that and the other, and there are all kinds of appendages, and money was going in many different directions to many different people. So on the civil side, the stakeholders were much more interested in having fewer, even if they are larger fees, than a lot of these individual one-off instances where they had to track and they had to make the payments. And so on the civil side, we increased filing fees and broadened them so there are fewer but larger fees. And then on the offense side, kind of the opposite occurred. We again did the same kind of consolidation process so there are fewer kind of moving parts in that process, but the fines were reduced. Judges were given more discretion to reduce and work fines, and so we modified the system to address what I think is fair to say were concerns about inequities, and the fines were so high that police officers were not citing because they felt the fine was inappropriate, so they were.
Yeah.
But that has resulted in an overall net loss of revenue, because there has not been an offset in the number of violations filed, whether that's officers are not responding in the way that people thought or there are fewer police officers, we don't really have a good handle on that. But So what this would do is propose a $5 increase in all offense, and so traffic, everything from traffic violations to crimes. We would ask that you apply that to local courts as well. And so when they collect that fine, what the portion that they send to the state would increase by that $5. And then that would help cover the costs of the local law enforcement, the local civil attorneys that, again, are using the OJSON system at no charge to them.
Steiner.
Thank you. So can you clarify the last bullet point on there? It says most non-paying users are public safety entities. Does that mean that people are using the system to get information they need about who's paid their fines or whatever? Educate me.
Can we go
please.
Back a couple slides to the non-paying?
I'm sorry if I didn't track properly.
No. This is what we're talking about here. These are people and entities, so it could be sheriff's offices, community corrections, juvenile departments. Most of these are public safety related. You can see through law enforcement, public defense, that kind of bottom almost half, 45% are the public safety users. Okay. And then I talked about there is a state versus local split. Mm-hmm. And so the state share is kind of the public defense, DOJ, DHS, that you see on the right-hand side. So that's why there's kind of different ways to fund this. But none of these people are charged for access to court documents. So, for example, if somebody has been sentenced by the court, shows up at the jail, for some reason they don't have their sentencing order. It used to be, you know, okay, got to go back to the courthouse, let's go get it, because we can't book him and admit him until mm-hmm. we have that. Now they log on, they get that, they have that, and it's done.
So basically the additional, if I may, Madam Chair, the additional $5 would just go towards helping support the use that they, the workload that's created by those people using it. Okay.
Yes, Senator. Thank you.
Perfect sense. I understand. Thank you for explaining it to me.
Sorry I didn't get there the first time.
No. I'm just new to this. This is all new. I'm one of the newbies on the committee.
Well, so Rep. Barker might remember this. When we went through the effort in 2011, we called it decomplexification. It wasn't just simplifying. That was too easy. We had to decomplexify it.
You have to decomplexify that word, well, Mr. Lemon. Yes.
Wasn't that one of the other factors when in 2011, not only the how much so officers weren't writing the tickets, but also the economy wasn't robust and you know, as then either. And so it was the, you know, I'm still thinking about some of the other things we had in place. So the ability of individuals to pay was also mm-hmm. at that time. So there were several, I think, factors that was going on in 2011.
The other piece was in 09-11, when the big recession hits and the judiciary, as well as everybody else, was looking at significant budget cuts, the legislature approved some temporary increases. And those, it went for 2 years and then expired. So in the 2011 session, we kind of took the previous structure, what those surcharges were, and that gave everyone an opportunity to sit down and look at the entire system, both on the civil side and the criminal side, and review how that revenue came in, how it was applied, and who it went to. Okay. So we tried to simplify on both sides of the equation, both coming in and internally. And then the last piece of this puzzle would be the OJSON user fees for those paying subscribers, the bar members, the news media, the title companies, and others. And when we started this fee structure, we were hopeful that in 2 or 3 years we'd be able to have a system that allows us to measure usage. And so we would know how much an individual or entity uses the system as and have that do from individual to individual to individual. We're still not there yet. We need a new technology portal to do that. And so what we did at the time was say we're going to look back 6 months, take your average bill, and that's going to be your cost. We've moved past that now. We think we need to bring everybody, all those grandfathered people, up to the minimum level and level the playing field and then move forward from there. And so that's what this $1.5 million represents. On this piece in particular, once we discuss and agree on a package with the legislature, then this particular piece does not need statutory approval. The process for this is the Chief Justice gives notice and comment opportunity to stakeholders. Then it's ratified, the money is ratified, the fees are ratified during the budget process, and we are good to go. The other piece I would mention is we did not include this in our proposal, but some stakeholders are interested in asking the legislature to impose a new assessment on state agencies. When we went back and looked at those non-paying users, we had kind of the public safety side and the civil side. We also had the state agencies, state entities, and the local entities. And so we can mix and match if you're interested in doing that. We did not include that in our specific proposal at this time. But that's just another way,
of allocating the cost. Mm-hmm. We do assess them for utilization of services from both DAS and the Attorney General's office and some of the other areas in the state. So we may want to have to take a look at that.
Yeah, that we just wanted to mention that as an option as we look at different ways of
allocating. They may not like it, but
well, the best one is the one the other person pays. Yes, and we understand that. So if there's no more questions on the tech fund piece for now, we'll move on. Judicial compensation is the first, what I would say, true add to the department's budget that we were asking for. The legislature created a Public Officials Compensation Commission, which in 2008 recommended that Oregon state judges be paid at the median salary of the 13 western states. And so that has been a request since then by every chief justice to get our judges up to that level. You have two bills, or the full committee co-chairs have two bills that have come through the judiciary committees on each in each chamber, and asking, they're identical bills, and asking for funding for that to happen. The legislature has authorized increases in the last several years. Those have been very gratefully received by the judges. They've been very important to retain the most experienced judges that we have on the bench. The legislature also approved a cost of living increase that is allocated in the same manner as executive branch management staff. And we think that those have been critical in retaining our most experienced judges on the bench as we approach. The bench is a very baby boomer oriented group of individuals, and we want to keep that experience and that expertise on the bench as long as we can, and this is a critical aspect of doing that. In the next slide, you'll see these are the 13 comparator states, the western states. The numbers that you see on the left are the national ranking on the absolute number for the salaries, just absolute dollars. So you can see Hawaii is the second highest paid in the state, and we're also looking at New Mexico, which is 51. We do have 51 reporting jurisdictions in this, not just the 50 states. When we came to you 3 or 4 years ago, you would have seen Oregon at 50th on that left-hand list. And so you can see that with your help and support, we've been able to move up. We are still about in the bottom third of where these judges are. This policy option package would give all the judges equal increases every January 1, starting in 2018, 2019, and 2020. That would get them to what was the median salary in 2016, which for circuit judges would be $152,850. The other thing I just wanted to talk about a little bit is it's very difficult for judges to come in and say, we deserve to be paid more. And it's not...
Kind of sounds like legislators.
It is. It, the difference is that you would be talking to yourselves and the judges talk to you. One of the reasons this is important is that if you look at what the salaries are paid to other judges, and that's what this chart represents, Oregon's judges are underpaid. If you look at other public attorneys in Oregon, they do not compare well. There are more than 100 senior assistant attorney generals in attorneys general in the Department of Justice who can make more than a circuit court judge. If you look at the average salary or compensation for a member of the Oregon State Bar, they are way behind. And as the bar took a salary survey in 2012, and by the time the average lawyer was in their 40s, they were making $145,000. That was 5 years ago. That's what the average lawyer made in the state of Oregon. We would like to think that our bench has above average lawyers, and we would like to see them compensated at that level. And really the ultimate question for the legislature is who do you want deciding these cases? Whether it's a small claims case and a dispute over whether you owe me $250 or $5,000, if it's a complex civil case, if it's a contract law, if it's an aggravated murder case, the same judges oftentimes throughout our state sit and hear these cases. And we want to make sure that they have both the high quality legal skills that are needed to do that, that they have some experience in the law to allow them to make good judgments and good decisions. We want them to have that level of dedication to public service, which we feel very strongly that they do. But we also want to find the right temperament, because they do deal with a variety of circumstances, with a variety of people who do not come to them, do not come to the court in the happiest of circumstances. And so it really takes a special person, I think, to really give each case the individual attention it needs and deserves, and to make sure that person feels as if they receive justice, as well as having it done so under the law. The chief's next priority is the courthouse capital construction and improvement. And these are the courthouse replacement projects that we talked about. So the OCCCIF was created in 2013 and generally is state bond support to replace unsafe courthouses. You'll notice the significant request for limitation there. That is not just the state bond funds, but that also the way the process is set up. When the state approves a courthouse project for state support for replacement, the county puts its match into that fund and gets returned back out to the county. But that dedicates that local money. First, it ensures that the local government has that money. Second of all, it dedicates that to the courthouse project. So that's an assurance for you that as this process moves forward, the county has the ability as well as the willingness to participate in these projects. State bond funds aren't the only proceeds that go into the OCCCIF, but that has been the use so far. The state pays up to 50% of the construction of the state portion of these facilities. And so if the building is 100% courthouse, then the state pays 50% of that construction project cost. If, as in some counties, the county has its own offices, whether they are administrative offices, district attorney offices, parole and probation, sheriff offices, any county offices are part of the project budget, but the state does not match those expenses. So if you see a lopsided request and wonder why the state's getting such a bargain by not paying 50%, the answer most likely is that that county has county space in there and they are paying for that 100%. And during public testimony tomorrow, we will have each of the four counties who are requesting or currently receiving and asking for additional replacement funds to come in and give you a brief presentation. And then we understand that in phase two, there will be a more detailed examination of these requests. So you will hear some overviews there. More specifically, in this package, we have the final construction request from the Multnomah County Courthouse. After we had initiated our budget process and our information was entered, they came back and wanted two bond sales instead of the traditional one. So we will be working with them to clarify what that means for you. It will mean some additional debt service if you agree to that. When the state assumed the costs for the judicial system in the early 80s, one of the things that agreed to continue providing is the equipment and the service and the supplies that go inside the walls, basically. And so as we build this new courthouse in Multnomah, we need to have some furnishings funded this biennium, because they are things like systems furniture walls that get plugged into the building. They are microphones and speakers in the ceilings that we need to have as part of the construction process. And so we are asking you to provide us with funding for that. We have a new project in Hood River, and their request would be for the complete project funds and then planning funding for a new courthouse in Clackamas County. When we go through this, the process to make these recommendations and requests to you, we work with the Association of Oregon Counties, and they convene all the counties who are interested in a courthouse replacement project. We have go through a process where we talk about what the need is, what the condition is, who's worst, who's in best position to come in and initiate and complete a courthouse replacement project. They make recommendations to the Chief Justice, and those show up in the OJD budget.
Phil, how far out is the planning for the courthouses?
I'll get to that in a couple slides, or you want me to answer it?
No, I'm okay. Just typically ahead?
That's an excellent question. You're only two slides ahead of me right now, Senator. But so we also have again, as we were developing our budget, there's another request that came in after we had completed. That is for additional funding for the Lane County Courthouse project. The legislature has authorized planning funds for that. Those will be sold, have been sold, and so those proceeds are available. The state sells its bonds at the end of the biennium and provides that money back to the county on a reimbursement basis. And so we are supportive of the Lane County request for this funding. These bonds would be sold at the end of the 2017-19 budget period. There would be no debt service in the 17-19 period, but that would assist the county in project management and cash flow management to make sure that that project is successful.
Weren't there some other issues surrounding Lane County and the trade-off and their lots and part of that process as well?
Yes, Senator. They are making... long story short, they have county-owned property that they were looking at. They have an opportunity to purchase and or swap for the old City Hall site, which is about so one is on this side of the current courthouse, the other is on that side of the current courthouse. They're looking at swapping or purchasing that City Hall property. That would allow them to create a greater proximity to the existing courthouse, but also to build horizontally instead of vertically, which would reduce costs. So that process is underway, but they're very encouraged by where they are, and I know the mayor of Eugene as well as the county commission were up here and talked to some of you recently. This is just a quick chronology of kind of how we got to where we are today. In 1981, the state unified the circuit court system. The state also assumed from the counties the cost of providing indigent defense for criminal defendants, and then the courthouse facilities and the responsibility for security of those facilities remained with the counties. The legislature then in that kind of stayed status quo for quite a while, and in 2007 the legislative body had an interim committee which developed statewide standards and commissioned an assessment of all 48 courthouse facilities in the state, and that serves as kind of the foundation of many of the recommendations that we come and talk to you about and the issues that we ask for help repairing. In 2013 the OCCCIF was established, and that created the bond match program. And also in 2013, the legislature gave criminal fines assessment account funds to Union County as its share as support to build a new courthouse in Union County. So the state, through various mechanisms, has built a new and opened a new courthouse in Union, has built and opened a new courthouse in Jefferson. We are asking for construction money for the Multnomah Courthouse and continue the Lane Courthouse project, and then ask you to consider two new projects in Hood River and Clackamas.
What happened to Tillamook?
Tillamook. Madam Chair, Tillamook came in and got the authority, the state authority, to authorize bonds and to come back in December with a more detailed plan. Their plan was to have a land sale that would provide them with the match they need to move forward with that project. Their land sale did not come up with the funds that they needed, and so we worked with them to try to reconfigure to do a different project, and they just decided they were not capable of participating in that. They do have, if you recall, they have some very urgent needs in that facility. We're continuing to work with them, and if we can come up with a plan that meets the court's needs that the county can afford, we'd like to come back to you later this session and ask for your support on that. That's still a very urgent need, and if you recall, there's a small courtroom there where criminal defendants literally walk within arm's reach of the jury,
right,
as they walk in, and the judge has to walk the same route, and it's, I hesitate to say unacceptable, but it's not a good situation at all.
And is Union County now happy with their?
They are very happy. The Chief Justice went out there, and when he closes at the end of the day, I'm sure he'd be glad to tell you about his experience out there. And I think Jefferson is equally happy, and Rep. Huffman was there for the dedication and opening of that facility.
Very nice.
So this just, again, there's two flavors of state assistance, two flavors of state money. One is the bond proceeds through the OCCCIF, and you can see that it's up to a 50% match for the court facility portion only. These are the three findings the Chief Justice has to make, that there are life safety threats to the existing building, that it's less expensive to replace or remodel a different facility than work within the current courthouse, and that the courthouse, the new project, would allow for the co-location of another state agency. We're trying to develop some efficiencies and get an additional state benefit for your investment in those facilities, and so that's what gets them from a 25% state match to a 50% state match. The legislature has also provided money through the criminal fines account for smaller improvement projects. We have, this is where the Union County funding came from, but again, we work with the AOC to come through and prioritize projects. There's always, as you can imagine, a very lengthy list of repairs and maintenance. We've replaced leaky roofs in Curry County. We've done ADA elevators in Columbia County and a variety of statewide projects, including life safety projects that are statewide.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Phil, didn't Sherman County decide to go ahead and self-fund their whole project?
Madam Co-Chair, Rep. Huffman, that's correct. They explored looking for state funding. But from our standpoint, we had already agreed to work with the Association of Oregon Counties and consider their recommendations. And Sherman County had not gone through that process, so we didn't feel in good faith we could support a request for state funding. And so they just decided they had the wherewithal to do it their own, so they did it. And I believe the opening for that is later this year, if I'm remembering correctly. OCCIF report. This is your question, Senator Winters. I finally caught up with you for now. There was a budget note attached to our budget that asked the Chief Justice to submit a 12-year plan and report to the Emergency Board in December. And so we took that opportunity to list out what the processes had been, the successes, the challenges, and kind of map out for you what the request might look like over the next 12 years to go out and see which counties thought now that they might request state assistance during that time. It's not binding on the Judicial Department. It's not binding on the legislature. It's not binding on the county. But we just kind of did a scan of the horizon. And so this is also how we got with the Clackamas and Hood River requests. Once those are done, or unless things change significantly, we would expect Benton and Lynn to come in 2019-21. Lincoln has a series of local capital projects that they would like to get through, but then they would like to look at replacing their courthouse facility. We have Columbia, and then we have some other counties who wanted to get their name on the list but didn't have any specific timeline or cost estimate in mind at this point. And so that's what it looks like. There is a page in our budget book that reflects what that would look like. We have a big bubble now because we are trying to finance construction of the Multnomah County Courthouse, and that obviously is a large project. So I'm sorry I didn't bring this or put in the slide, but you can see that we have a big bubble arise right now when the expenditure limitation we're requesting because of Multnomah, and then we would go back to what we would hope would be a more stable and consistent level of requests. But it really varies on the size of the project and what their timing of their needs are.
And are all of the plans, the construction plans, including seismic?
The ones that we have plans for now, yes, Senator.
Yes. I'm...
And that is the primary motivation for all these courthouse projects is the lack of seismic upgrades and protections in these courthouse facilities.
I'm just thinking about the Cascadia.
Absolutely. Well, and if you, the Clackamas request, when we did the 2008 assessment, they scored fairly well on the condition of their courthouse facility. There was some seismic review, but they did two studies in 2015 that showed that if there is an earthquake, the land that courthouse is sitting on turns into pudding and the courthouse slides into the river. And so there is that level. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but
hello.
They call it, well, Senator Steiner Hayward asked me to not use the big words, and so it's liquefaction
or something. Mr. Lemon, like that. That is not what I said. I love big words. I even know a whole song about big words.
Well, you're a doctor. I know you know big words. But those recent studies really shone a different light on the condition of and the threat to the Clackamas County Courthouse, and so that raised them, even though they weren't particularly high.
Given how much work, and particularly from the engineering standpoint and looking to the future, and I don't know whether there is collaboration with ODOT and what have you, because as we, you know, those of us who run, and I'm learning a whole new career now with joint transportation, but, you know, as you begin to look at Oregon and begin to plan across the state, what have you, and, you know, it just seems to me, and emergency preparedness, that there needs to be a lot more working together on where we go in the future. I see I see my chronologically advantaged colleague saying yes to.
Mm-hmm. Got a wheelchair down the road.
Yes.
Shooters. We also provided a series of recommendations to the legislature on how this process might work more smoothly and be easier for everyone to work with. As we mentioned, the legislature has never said we would like you to try to smooth out so there are consistent biennial requests for X amount of bond funds. If the legislature wants to engage in that discussion, we'd be glad to do that. But really, it's just been project by project. We come to you when the county is ready, willing, and able, and they're all queued up to do that. The process does not have a lot of formal structure in terms of rules and deadlines and timelines and how it's structured. I think that there is some room to do that would help both bring projects on a consistent basis, and the legislature spent a fair amount of time establishing a stage gate process with expectations on how agencies come in with IT projects and what you have to get this funding and then what you have to have in place for the next step. We could take that approach and apply some of that, those principles at least, to the courthouse projects. The legislature has moved more toward a phased funding, so it will approve planning funds, and that gives the counties the ability to come back with a more detailed proposal, and I think that's very beneficial for everyone with a relatively small investment by the state, and that improves how we do these projects. I did want to cover a couple more of the priority POPs and then give a brief discussion of what did not make the priority list, even though they are important to the chief. So if we're...
Yeah, I see your other colleague coming in, too.
The next priority for the chief, and he discussed this, some are the new judgeships. again, we had a statewide study that showed the need for 30 new judges. There are currently 173 circuit court judges, so you can see the scope of the need statewide. The Chief Justice narrowed that down to 9. Representative Stark wanted him to cut that list even further. The chief will be negotiating with himself and then come back with a shorter list for you to consider.
Co-chair.
Yes,
Winter,
co-chair.
To clarify, I did not ask him to cut it. He said if he were to bid against himself, he was hoping for at least 3. So,
I apologize. I took that as a little more directive than just an idle comment. At any rate, I wanted to give you just a flavor for what these various courts are looking at and why they're coming, why they made the list, and why we're coming to you asking for new judgeships in these counties. So in Clackamas County, they already are resetting about a quarter of their criminal and civil trials. So 1 in 4 trials, the attorneys show up, the parties show up, the expert witnesses show up, the victim of the crime shows up, and are told we can't have a trial today because we're booked. And so that's happening in 1 of 4 cases in Clackamas County already. They also have 7 treatment courts in Clackamas County, and we all know the benefits of those, but that takes, as the chief said, a lot more judge time, and when judge time is a commodity, it's really a stretch for the court to make those happen. In Marion County, they also have extensive use of treatment courts, and again, those are 100% general funded. When we do get grants from CJC or another source, those are primarily for treatment dollars and sometimes for coordinator positions. They do not pay for judge time, and so that is a, if you will, an in-kind contribution by the Judicial Department to move forward those courts. In Marion, they also have all the state cases. It's the first stop for challenges to laws, for election law issues. They also have prisons and the state hospital here, and there's a lot of litigation and criminal prosecution that comes from a result of that. The Marion County Justice Courts were just consolidated, and as a process of that, they quit taking criminal cases. So the misdemeanor cases that used to go through the justice courts now come to the circuit court. In Washington County, the last judge was added 14 years ago, and before that it was another 9 years. And so between those two judicial additions, the population has gone up 200,000 people. They would like to develop a restoration court to help process aid and assist cases so they can keep more people who need evaluation and mental health services in the community as opposed to sending them to the state hospital for evaluation. They're hard-pressed to do that because of the time it takes to devote to that relatively small population. They also are pushed to hear the justice reinvestment cases. Those are cases that involve downward departures. These are people who ordinarily would get a prison sentence. They are requested to impose a probation sentence, but that, again, requires a greater degree of deliberation, of working with the parties, and also more court appearances to work through that process. Washington does have a courtroom ready and waiting and would just love to hear you say go so they can start with the process to hear that. In Deschutes County, they've moved to a master calendar to improve the efficiency of their judicial assignments. They still reset 20% to 25% of their civil, criminal, and family law trials, so they have a similar issue. The presiding judge submitted testimony to House Judiciary saying it takes 10 weeks to schedule a sentencing hearing. So the person is found guilty, and to take that next step takes more than 2 months. They are doing a new dissolution pilot where if they have two unrepresented parties in a marriage dissolution case, those people can agree to a more informal process where they present their arguments directly to the judge. They do not pay, they do not follow the rules of evidence quite the same way, but it gives these people the chance to talk to the judge directly and have him hear from directly from both sides of that disagreement. They report a very high level of satisfaction, and people love being heard and feel that justice is better served when they do that. But again, it takes a lot more time and attention from an individual judge to do that. In Josephine County, the last new judge there was 36 years ago, probably before Rep Stark was born. How am I doing here? This is working at all. Total filings in that court were up 24% in the last year. Felonies have doubled in the last 10 years. Their permanency hearings and dependency cases are up 50% between 2015 and 2016 alone. They have a very high failure to appear rate because of their lack of public safety resources. What that means to the court is while you have that person in front of you, it's best to work with them and get that case resolved right now because it may be a while before they come back. They also have a courtroom available now if and when the legislature approves a new position. Multnomah County, excuse me.
He wants to defend his age. Stark.
I'll settle down.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. I just wanted to make a quick comment because there's been lots of pokes at Josephine County. All those increases are without significant law enforcement in the county. And imagine if we ever actually do pass a levy and have law enforcement out there, how much more the caseload would go up.
Thank you.
Are you making an argument to keep your caseloads down?
Yeah. I believe the county commissioners and the sheriff also submitted testimony in support of that new judicial position, so they all see a need. Multnomah is our state largest court. It has many, many of the complex civil cases. It has also a very extensive array of treatment courts. About a fourth of their civil cases has at least one party who is not represented, and three-quarters of their family law cases have at least one party who is not represented by an attorney. They are also very involved in the justice reinvestment efforts and are doing a lot of community outreach and listening about racial disparities in the Multnomah County community. Last one is Douglas County. They also have had a surge in dependency in criminal cases and restraining orders. They have a longstanding drug and domestic violence court. They have a newer mental health court that they would very much like to continue, and they also have a courtroom ready and waiting. All these courts, to the best of their ability, use pro tem judges, volunteers who come in and hear various types of cases. They have mediation programs. They have facilitators in family law cases, but at some point you have to have a judge available to hear and decide that case. Multnomah County violation staffing. Multnomah County, by statute, serves as the municipal court for the city of Portland, and so processes about 250,000 excuse me, parking violations. That caseload fluctuates somewhat, but again, that court lost positions in the 2009 reductions. Would like to have additional positions so they can process those cases in a more timely way. And the other benefit that is important to this committee to know is that would bring in additional revenue to the state, because a portion of those fines do come to the state. The treatment, POP 409 is the treatment of specialty courts. We talked about that a little bit, Senator Winter, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time with that. These are basically grant-funded positions, and authorizing this just allows the department to accept and receive those grant funds and continue coordinators for those various courts.
And Phil, I just noted that Mr. Shatterly has also arrived, so.
Yes, we reserve time for him at the end, and so I'm holding up the Chief Justice and former Representative Shatterly. I'm very aware of that. So in closing, I would like just to say the pro se facilitation is the other one of the Chief Justice priorities. These, again, were staff that the courts lost. These people help provide direct assistance without practicing law to these people without lawyers and family law cases, and they are very important to the active management. Because of the pressing of time, I will not go through the other POPs, but you did hear some of those yesterday. I'd be glad to answer any questions before my boss comes up.
If there are no further questions, I'd like to call up the boss.
Where's Bruce?
and boss, are you bringing up, are you?
Mr.
Shatterly?
No, he's, I don't think he wants to be seen with me. You come on.
Okay.
How are you?
Good.
To see you.
Chair Winters and members of the committee, for the record, Tom Ballmer, I have the privilege of being Chief Justice and head of the Oregon Judicial Department. I know there will be public testimony tomorrow and additional hearings later in the session, but I wanted to close just with a couple thoughts. And Rep. Huffman, you understood from our judicial position slide that we do have one for Deschutes County. I think Mr. Lemon looked at you and thought Hood River, and I guess you have part of Deschutes, if I'm not mistaken. So I understand, members of the committee, that we are in a deficit situation, and that even funding our current service level, let alone POPs for new judges, judicial compensation, and additional staff in the targeted areas seems like a lot to ask. But I really think it's critical for folks in our state to have an adequately funded judicial system. First, the fact is we have been historically underfunded, and in the past decade, it's gotten worse. You saw the chart yesterday. There was the picture that sort of looked like a hockey stick that showed the decline in our FTEs. We have 9.5% fewer FTEs, fewer positions than we did 10 years ago. That's 162 warm bodies in our circuit courts around the state, helping people with divorces, protecting and finding permanency for kids in the welfare system, and enforcing our criminal laws. And people in our central office here in Salem, keeping eCourt up and running and making sure our judges and staff understand and implement the new initiatives that you and the legislature put forward. On the judge side, it's been more than 10 years, going back to the 2005 session, since we added any trial court judges. Now, we appreciate that our courts have been reasonably funded in a reasonably stable way over the past few years, but they've been stable at an underfunded level. So when we look at a caseload that is declining in some areas and in some case categories, it's not appropriate to say, okay, that means you can reduce your workforce, you don't need new judges. We already have reduced our workforce, and we have needed additional judges for many years. We asked for them for a number of years. We stopped asking when it seemed to be a fool's errand. We, in the last session and then this session, we are asking for additional judges. Second, I hope our presentation has helped you, and particularly those of you who are new to this subcommittee, to understand how deeply integrated the court system is to virtually everything that happens in this state. Our little picture of the courts is the core through which issues in our society get resolved, sometimes for better, sometimes not always, tries to make that plain. But the courts aren't just the center of a legal system that includes lawyers and DAs and the legislature and so on. We're at the center of the public safety system because it's here that the criminal laws are enforced while constitutional rights are protected. We're in the middle of child welfare and family law proceedings when things go wrong for families and children. We're critical to the functioning of the economy because it's in court that businesses and individuals protect their economic rights, deal with employment and other disputes, and enforce consumer protection laws. We did have a slide that addressed the drivers of our workload, from more social workers at DHS to new laws to changes in law enforcement budgets and policies. Many of the policy initiatives that the legislature and the executive branch put forward must go through the courts, and they affect our workload. We fully support the emphasis in recent years on treatment and specialty courts that hold the real promise of keeping low-level offenders out of prison, thereby saving money, with their families and employers, thereby helping families and the economy, and also holding them accountable and helping them deal with their drug or alcohol or mental health issues. But that takes a lot of judge and staff time, as Mr. Lemon talked about a little bit earlier. A trial judge can easily take 20 or more guilty pleas, you know, in a few hours. But if she's running a drug court, the number of individuals she can see is much, it's far, far fewer. And those people come back week after week. So you might have an evidence-based program that has a lot of financial and other benefits to the public and to some specific individuals, but it takes more time in court, and the courts cost more money. So this example also shows not just the impacts of others on our workload and therefore our budget, because 90% of our budget is personnel costs, but also how what we do affects other entities. Oftentimes, we save other entities in this state a lot of money. When we do video arraignments, that means the sheriffs don't have to transport somebody from the jail to the courthouse and back again. When we do post-conviction proceedings in Salem rather than in Pendleton, where Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution is, that saves the Department of Corrections a lot of money. There are big savings for sheriff's offices, for DAs, for Department of Corrections. E-court and the ability of our public service partners to get all these documents online is a huge cost savings for many other institutions in the system. We don't get any of that money. We save other people money because we're doing the right thing, but we don't see any of that. So we depend upon this committee understanding how integrated we are with other government institutions and making sure that we're sufficiently funded to do this work, which spreads benefits, including cost savings, far beyond the Oregon Judicial Department. So finally, it does cost several hundred million dollars a year to operate this branch of government, and that's a lot of money. But it's less than 3% of the general fund. So the $3.2 million, for example, that's in our POP to help self-represented people who are crowding the courts get their cases through in a fair and efficient and timely manner. I mentioned that earlier. It's 17 FTEs. That is a big deal for us. That's putting these people in place around the state. That's almost a rounding error in K through 12 education or DHS or the OHA budget. And I'm not saying that just because these are relatively modest costs, you should just go ahead and fund them. What I am saying is that I think we've tried to be, and we've shown ourselves to be, to this committee and your predecessors, good stewards of the people's money. We've wrung inefficiencies out of the OJD, and we've changed our court processes to be faster and more efficient and to operate with as few people as we can over the past 7 years. We will put every penny that you provide to us to good use. So I will hope you will look generously, prayerfully at our budget and give due consideration to it. And I look forward to answering any questions you have today and to our next round of hearings. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief Justice Bummer. And I think with that, I will ask my former colleague, Lane Chatterley, for Representative Lane Chatterley, who's now the chair of the Oregon Law Commission, and I think you can do it. You're very effective and efficient in telling the story in about 10 minutes.
Oh, Madam Co-Chair, I can do it in 10 minutes.
Good.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Lane Shetterly, here in my capacity this afternoon as chair of the Oregon Law Commission. Some of you I know have been around and seen the product of the commission over several biennia, several sessions. Some of you may not have, so I'll be very quick to introduce just what the Law Commission is. It was created in 1997 by the legislature to conduct a continuous ongoing program of law revision and law reform. It was set up by statute, and its membership is established by statute to include members of the judicial, executive, and legislative branches, as well as appointees of the Oregon State Bar and the three deans of Oregon law schools, or their designees. So it's a very high-level commission. And the work that we do tends to be, and if you look at the product in the budget package that you were emailed earlier, if you look at the history of the commission, it tends to be legislation that is generally more complex and requires a long-term heavy lift by experts in the fields of law with which we deal. And I use the three bills that we have in this session is excellent examples of that in a couple of ways. One bill that we have is probate modernization, updating the probate code in the way in which estates are processed through our court system. Another bill establishes for the first time ever a receivership code. What happens in the context of a receivership when you have a debtor in business, in operation, where the creditors don't want to put that debtor out of business but want to make sure that the business is operated for the benefit of creditors so that creditors can realize claims that they have against the debtor. And the other being a direct criminal appeals bill that is doing a terrific job at clarifying many obtuse and obscure and confusing rules in statute and in case law regarding criminal case appeals, that is, in terms generally of what is appealable and if it's appealable, what is reviewable. It's an area that has generated just a great deal of litigation over the several years leading up to this, and we're hoping and doing excellent work to clarify those rules so that practitioners and courts will know, have a roadmap to govern criminal appeals to streamline that process. In each of those cases, what we are doing for the state and for our joint constituents, we're reducing costs. We are reducing costs of litigation. We're doing costs of process in the receivership. We're creating a code that we've never had before that is going to give guidance to how those processes work. Direct criminal appeals, reducing litigation and appeals over the issue of what is appealable. And so we benefit the state through the work that we do in that respect. We are also benefit the state because over the years we've established a degree of credibility in the work of the Law Commission that we are able to bring into our work groups some of the very brightest lawyers in the fields of expertise in which the projects are dealing. And you see on page 2 of the memo that we submitted, and I'll just give you this quickly. In this session, looking at taking the number of practicing attorneys who volunteer their time, usually at least once a month and in many cases twice a month, to meet as Law Commission work groups, and applying the 2012 median hourly billable rate. That's just the most recent that we have, so we think it's conservative. We've estimated that the value of lawyer time put into our work groups this session has been almost $600,000. And that's, again, a conservative estimate because we're using old numbers. But that's because you have these lawyers who are at the peak of their practices and expert in each of the areas that we're dealing with, believe in the work of the Law Commission and are committed to law improvement through the process that we do. And so we have the benefit of reducing cost and litigation through the work that we do in clarifying complex areas of the law. We bring to bear the great expertise among the Oregon Bar of the lawyers that are willing and to volunteer their time and hours in service. And we leverage the resources of Oregon Law School. We've been at Willamette University for the past 16 years. We're in the process now of transitioning to the University of Oregon. We're looking at relocating to the University of Oregon at the beginning of July in the next biennium. And through the University of Oregon, we will benefit from their support in terms of what they are able to provide to the Law Commission in the way of support through their services there. So we leverage a lot of dollars. Our budget to you is presented in the project is presented in the memo that we've presented. Basically, the roll up for the Law Commission budget would amount to $365,000, almost $366,000. With the move to the University of Oregon, there's a gap. We have one policy option package, number 420, that would close that gap. That's for $22,000, basically. And that would sustain the commission at the level that we have right now. And that is one full-time director and a part-time office assistant. That's all we have. That's who manages these work groups. We did include a policy option package for a staff attorney to expand the capacity. That's policy option package number 421 for $185,000, because we're basically maxed out in terms of our bandwidth with one person to manage all of these projects going on. I'll tell you, we get lots of requests from legislators, judges, and other people who are interested in projects, very important projects that the Law Commission could and should be taking on, and we like to say yes to everybody, but our bandwidth is limited with the funding and the capacity that we have, and so we're asking you for the opportunity to expand that bandwidth so that we can serve you better in the work that we do. I think I'll end it there. I'm probably just about the end of the time that you
I'll ask if there's any questions of the one who used to sit on this side of the
never in this committee. I was always in revenue down the other end of the hall.
Yes, he was
raising the money for you to spend.
Yes. Well, if there's no further questions, thank you for your presentation.
You.
And I just have to say, because I know that one who's worked on dependency cases a lot, who's sitting out there in the audience, and I just have to acknowledge Judge Waller because of all the work that she's done, and I'm a big fan of hers and the work that's being done on dependency cases. So just wanted to say thanks for coming, and I know you're going to be here tomorrow. And if there's no further questions, we are adjourned. We are adjourned. Questions.